Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit was obviously a very important part of the original sin narrative, but was it the only part? I would dare say that what happened immediately after they ate the forbidden fruit was just as impactful, if not more so, than eating the fruit itself. We're going to discuss that on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. Please go check it out. You'll find a ton of great materials there, as well as the blog and this very podcast. We have been discussing the first dispensation, the so-called Age of Innocence, with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. We've spent the last couple podcasts talking about it, and we're going to wrap up that narrative, which is outlined in Genesis chapter 3, in this podcast. In the very first podcast in this series, we looked at the creation of the first man and woman. We looked at Eden and what the roles of Adam and Eve were in Eden. We also looked at the fact that Eden was not just a garden, but also a mountain where God dwelt and where his holiest angels, who were part of his divine council, also dwelt. In the last podcast, last week, we began to look at the original sin and the fall of man by looking at the temptation of Eve and the eating of the forbidden fruit. And we did that by taking a really close examination of the so-called serpent in the garden, or nakash, which is the actual word in Hebrew. And we saw pretty clearly that the nakash is not a regular old garden snake. It was not a serpent or a snake at all. It was, in fact, the malevolent being known as Lucifer or Satan. And we looked at how and why he tempted Eve, and the obviously the consequence being that, you know, she ate the fruit and then she gave it to Adam and he ate. So in this podcast, we're going to wrap up the Eden narrative by looking at what happened right after they ate the fruit and the impact that had on original sin. We're going to look at what original sin really was in total, because it wasn't just the eating of the fruit. As I said at the beginning, what happened after they ate the forbidden fruit is, I think, even more important to original sin and what it really means than the actual eating of the fruit itself. So let's just dive right in. So Eve ate the fruit. She gave it to Adam. He ate the fruit. So what happened next? Well, the first thing that happened is that the Bible says in Genesis 3, their eyes were open and they saw that they were naked. Now, does this really mean that they just realized they both weren't wearing shorts and they have genitalia? I don't think so. I'm pretty sure. I think it's safe to say that this is not the first time Adam and Eve looked at each other. Now, I don't know how long they were in the garden. The Bible isn't very clear how long Adam and Eve were in Eden before they ate the fruit and fell, but I think it was more than just a few seconds. I think they were there maybe days, maybe months. I don't think they were there years, because if they had been there for years, they would have had kids by now, because that was one of God's first commandments to them, was to, you know, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. I mean, they were the kings and queens of the earth, and their children, their descendants, were to also rule over the earth and basically turn the earth into Eden. That was the goal, the role of Adam and Eve. We talked about that a couple podcasts ago. But I think they were around long enough to actually have looked at each other before. So this cannot be the first time they said, hey, oh, look at you. No, I don't think that's what happened at all. So when the Bible says that they realized they were naked, there has to be something, you know, more going on than them just realizing that they were disrobed. Now, obviously, they were not wearing clothes, because the Bible says, again, Genesis 3, that after they realized they were naked, the first thing they did was sew fig leaves together to make themselves aprons to cover themselves. And this actually is the first religious act in the Bible. Now, the first religious thought, the first religious philosophy, was done by Eve a few verses before, when the Nakash, when Satan questioned her about eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and Eve said that not only can you not eat it, but you also can't touch it. That was religion, because that's not something that God told her. That was something that she decided to add on to God's law, and that's part of the definition of religion, and we'll talk about more about religion in a few podcasts. But the first religious act, the first actions that were religious, were Adam and Eve sewing these fig leaves together to cover up their nakedness, to cover it up from God, to cover up this shame they felt from God. And that's, again, that's an act that they did that was not intended from God. So it's an act of religion. So if this nakedness wasn't just them saying, oh my God, we need to, you know, go to the store and buy some underwear, what did it really mean? Well, I think it means more than just being disrobed. You have people like Chuck Missler, who I happen to admire. He's been a mentor of mine, a long distance mentor, and I you know admire his work a lot. He had a theory that Adam and Eve, in their unfallen state, didn't just occupy three dimensions, the three spatial dimensions that we do. That they were actually in their unfallen state, they were on a higher plane of existence, and they were in fact clothed with light. And when they sinned, when they broke God's law, they lost that radiance, and that's what they realized, that you know they were no longer clothed with light. They were no longer in God's good graces. And I think that's a part of it, but I think it gets even deeper into that. And to really understand that, we have to look at our Bible translations. Now, the first translation of the Bible into English was the King James Version that was done, 500 years ago. And most of the other English translations that we have, the NIV and the Revised Standard Version, all these others, most of them are paraphrases of the original King James. The problem is that in the King James, it was well done at the time, but it was translated 500 years ago into Old English, into the King's English, which we don't speak today. We don't speak that same type of English. We don't say thou and thine and shalt and wherefore and all those sorts of things that, you know, that's part of the vernacular of the King's English from 500 years ago. But then there are a lot of topics and a lot of words that meant one thing in the King's English 500 years ago that means something else now. And one of those words is nakedness and having nakedness uncovered. A good way to understand this is to go to some of the other places in the Bible where nakedness and nakedness being covered and uncovered are mentioned. I'll give you a couple of examples. One is in the Levitical laws. And of course, the Levitical laws were put in place. I have a whole series on the law on faithbyreason.net. You can go there and click on the law category, and I give you the reasons behind the law. But they were about the conduct and practices that Israel was supposed to embrace and maintain in order to separate them as God's chosen nation, and to separate them from the other pagan and unbelieving nations of the world. And one of the practices that was pretty rampant in the pagan cultures around them was incest, having sexual relations with relatives. And when the Levitical laws talk about this, they basically say you shall not uncover the nakedness of your relatives. You'll see in Leviticus it says, you shall not uncover your sister's nakedness. You should not uncover your brother's nakedness, or your mother's or your aunt's or your uncle's nakedness. Now, it's not saying that, you shouldn't go and peek in on your sister when she's taking a shower. Now, of course, you shouldn't do that because that's gross. But it's not talking about just looking at one of your relatives in a naked state. It's talking about sexuality. It's saying that you should not have sexual relations with your close relatives. And it's and in the King's English, it's saying you shall not uncover their nakedness. So uncovering their nakedness is clearly the idea of inappropriate intimacy, specifically on a sexual level. And that's more than just seeing them without clothes on. And I'll give you another example that's much more controversial. And I'm going to give it to you mostly because I just love controversy and love making people think and making people uncomfortable by exposing some things that, no pun intended, by exposing some biblical ideas that maybe they haven't thought of before or have not been presented in before or that they like to avoid. And this example is from Noah. Noah, we always know about Noah and the flood and the ark, and we're going to talk about that in the second dispensation down the road a bit. But this is something that happened with Noah after the flood waters had receded. I think it's in Genesis chapter 9, around the middle of that chapter. It says that after the flood waters receded, Noah became a farmer, and he started farming. And one of the things he was farming was grapes, and he took some of the grapes and he made wine. Man after my own heart, love a good glass of wine. But unfortunately, Noah took a little too far. And he got drunk, and he was drunk and passed out in his tent. And I'm going to paraphrase the passage, but it basically says he was passed out in his tent, and he was naked. He was uncovered in his tent. And one of his sons, Ham, he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham walks in, sees the nakedness of his father, goes out and tells his other two brothers. Two brothers come back. They walk into the tent backwards with a garment so they don't see their father's nakedness. They cover him up. And then a little later on, Noah wakes up from his drunken stupor, and he realized that something was done to him. Keep that in mind. Something was done to him. He realizes that. And he curses his grandson, who's the son of his son Ham. He curses his grandson Canaan. Now, what's going on here? Was Noah really that outraged that he was naked and his sons saw him? And why would he curse the grandson Canaan? Well, there's several pretty things here that logically and biblically don't fit the narrative of, oh, he's just having to pass out and he got naked and his son saw him and he got outraged and put a blood curse on him. I think that was a little bit of an overreaction. First of all, when you pass out drunk, your clothes don't fly off. Okay, folks, I've been drunk before and I've passed out. Sorry, I'm not perfect. I went to college and that was something that happened almost every other weekend where I drank too much and lost consciousness. I've gotten over, but it happened. Sorry, you can take me off the pedestal now. But whenever I woke up from being drunk, my clothes were generally still on, you know, of their own accord. I didn't fall down drunk and my clothes suddenly fly off. That's not something that happens when you get drunk, even if you're wearing a robe, as I assumed Noah did at the time. Being drunk and falling down doesn't make you spontaneously disrobe. So that doesn't make any sense. Secondly, if it was just a matter of him being disrobed and his son saw it, why would that make him pronounce a blood curse on someone? I mean, seeing your male relatives isn't naked isn't like, you know, something that you want to do. I don't want to necessarily see any of my male relatives naked. It's not something I desire, but it's not a huge outrage. For example, my grandfather, before he passed away, he had multiple sclerosis, which is, you know, a terrible disease that basically renders your muscles inoperative. He got to the point where he couldn't move around. He couldn't really move his arms and legs on his own. And, you know, I was helping my grandmother take care of him. And that sometimes that meant that I had to help, you know, clean him up, you know, and bathe him. And he was obviously in a disrobed state when I bathed him. And he wasn't ashamed of it. I wasn't ashamed of it. It was just something that, you know, it had to happen. I was taking care of him. So seeing a male relative, a relative of the same sex, disrobed in a distressed situation, you know, it's not something you necessarily desire, but it's not something that would outrage you to the point where you'd pronounce a blood curse on them. And furthermore, why was Canaan, the grandson, cursed? Well, let's take a closer look at this passage, and I see you're going to see some things that you may not have heard before. I can only maybe count a couple times when I've heard a Bible teacher really talk about what's actually happening here in a way that made sense biblically and logically. Now, although this situation seems to just involve Noah and his three sons, you know, there's Canaan. He's inserted there. If you go to Genesis 9 and you look at verses 18 and verse 22, it seems that Moses, who penned Genesis, is going out of his way to insert Canaan, the grandson, into the story in a subversive way, not overtly, but subversively, so that you know that Canaan is a part of this, even though he is not directly in the narrative until Noah curses him. So Canaan plays a key role in whatever's going on. And I'm just going to just be blunt. What happened to Noah is that he was molested homosexually. He was raped when he passed out in his tent. He was raped by Canaan. How do I get this? Well, first of all, let's remember that uncovering nakedness is about inappropriate sexual intimacy. So we know that. So when it says he was passed out uncovered in his tent, that is clearly talking about something sexual is happening. And since we know Canaan is mentioned prominently for what doesn't seem like a good reason until he's cursed, and because Noah cursed him, I believe that's very strongly implied here that Noah got drunk, passed out, his grandson Canaan comes in, and he basically rapes him. Sorry, there's no other, I hate to be graphic, but there's really no other way to say it. He has homosexual sex with him. Well, it's not sex, it's rape. With his grandfather, which is gross and disgusting, but as we'll find out in a few minutes, Canaan is kind of a gross and disgusting person. Ham, his other son, walks in and he sees that his father is uncovered. He sees his nakedness. Remember, nakedness is inappropriate sexual intimacy. He either sees the act still happening or he sees the aftermath of the rape. And I'm not going to go into graphic detail of what the aftermath would look like. You can use your own imagination, but there would obviously be a situation where you could tell, you know, something bad happened. And he goes out and he tells his two brothers, and they and this makes sense why they will walk in backwards. They would not want to see this, either the act happening or the aftermath of the act. So they walked in backwards and they covered him up. Noah woke up and he realized something was done to him. And again, without getting too graphic, I would just, if you just understand the mechanics of homosexual sex, if it happened to you when you woke up, you would know that something was a little different physiologically. I'll just leave it at that. In fact, it specifically says that he knew what his younger son had done to him. Now, those who want to gloss over this idea of Canaan raping Noah, they try to say, well, he was talking about Ham. He realized that Ham had done something to him. Well, that doesn't make sense for a couple of reasons. Number one, how would he know that Ham walked in and saw him and walked out? There's no physical evidence of what Ham did. And secondly, Ham is not his youngest son. In the Bible, whenever families are talked about in order, they always go from oldest to youngest. Whenever people are listed, it's from the oldest to the youngest. And whenever you see the three sons listed, it's always Shem, Ham, and Japheth, which means that Shem is the oldest, Ham is the middle son, and Japheth is the youngest. So Ham's not the youngest son. Japheth is, and Japheth was one of the sons who did the right thing, so Noah would not realize that Japheth had done anything to him. Japheth hadn't done anything to him, and neither had Ham or Shem. However, younger son could also easily be translated in this context as grandson. He realized his grandson had done something to him, probably because he knew, had some ideas that Canaan was kind of a pervert. And we know that, or we can intimate that Canaan had proclivity for homosexuality. Why? Because some of his most infamous descendants are the people who were in the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we know Sodom and Gomorrah very well from the story of when they were destroyed, when Abraham's nephew, Lot, was living in Sodom, and he was actually sitting in the gates of Sodom, which means he was one of the elders, one of the leaders of Sodom. And don't ask, let's not get into how he got that position. But anyway, two angels come in to rescue him, and the men of Sodom think these angels are other men, and they surround Lot's house and demand that Lot bring these angels out so that they can, well, again, without being, at the risk of being graphic, gang rape them. Sorry, that's, look up the story yourself. That's what was happening. So those are Canaan's descendants. So the point is that this is a story about inappropriate sexual intimacy. And that is why Noah pronounced that blood curse on Canaan, because Canaan committed the act. So, yeah, sorry, I went on a tangent there. So let's get back to Adam and Eve. So they realized they were naked. What does that mean? It means not that they just saw that they didn't have clothes on. I believe that they gained an awareness that they were in a fallen and shameful state. They looked at each other and realized we are not where we were before. They became ashamed. They felt guilty. And this is really important. We're going to talk about it in the next podcast, but they felt guilt for the first time, and they felt guilt and shame. And that guilt and shame was associated with their being physically naked. They were physically naked. They did not have clothes on, but they were covering themselves up because I think they started to get a long-term understanding of what the long-term implications are of nakedness and sexuality. And I'm going to talk about this a lot more. I'm going to run out of time, so I'm not going to get into it too much. But I talk about it in a blog post called Eating Yourself to Death. I'll put a link to it, where I get into details of why they would feel ashamed about not just being naked, but the implications, the sexual implications of it. All right, so they realize they're naked. They hide from God. And so God's walking through the garden in the cool of the day. And yes, God can take on physical form. He's done it in the past. He did it famously with Abraham, ironically, right before the Sodom and Gomorrah issue, where God and two angels come down. They actually eat and have dinner with Abraham. So God was walking through the garden, and he asked Adam, and he said, "Hey, Adam, where are you?" Now, not because God didn't know where he was. Obviously, God knew that. But here's what's important. God knows what happened. You know, you can't hide anything from God. God knew that they sinned. He knew they ate the forbidden fruit. But God did not immediately rain judgment down on them. Now, he would judge them in a few verses, but that's not the first thing he did. And this is crucially important to understanding original sin. God did not judge them immediately. If original sin was just eating the forbidden fruit, God would have pronounced judgment and we'd have to move on to the next dispensation. But he didn't. What did God do? God started asking them questions. And the answers to these questions are the most important part of original sin. And we'll see why in a couple minutes. So when God asked Adam, "Where are you?" it wasn't because he didn't know where Adam was. He wanted to get Adam's answer. And what did Adam say? Adam said, "I was naked and I hid from you." Okay, so he's admitting that he's guilty. So, okay, that's actually not a bad thing. He could actually recover from this. So then God says, "Well, who told you you were naked?" I think that was kind of a rhetorical question because God didn't wait for an answer. Then he asked him the question to try to get a confession from him. God asked him, "Did you eat from the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil?" Again, God knows he did this. He's not asking because he doesn't know. He wants to get Adam's response. He wants to see how Adam is going to react to this. So that's the most important thing. So what did Adam say? Basically, Adam had two choices. Adam could have either justified himself or he could have justified God. He could have said, we know what he said. We know the familiar story, but here's what he could have done. Adam could have said, "Yes, I ate the fruit." And that's pretty obvious. He could have confessed, "I ate the fruit." And he could have said, "God, I did the wrong thing. I disobeyed your law. You were very clear about it. I'm sorry. You know, what kind of restitution can I make?" That's what he could have done. And if he had done that, I believe that God may have found a way to forgive him. I can't say that for sure. It's total conjecture on my part. But I believe that God's response would have been very different. There may have been a way for Adam to have been reconciled back to God if he had confessed and repented. But he didn't. He did not justify God. It would have been justifying God to confess and repent. Say, "I was wrong. What can I do to make it right?" He didn't. He actually did the other way around. He justified himself. What did he do? He said, "Yes." I'm paraphrasing again. He said, "Yes, God, I ate the forbidden fruit. But it's because of that woman you gave me. If you hadn't given me that heifer, that harpy, she's the one who tempted me and I ate." Oh, Adam, that was the worst thing you can do. He essentially blamed God. He basically said, "Yeah, God, I ate it. I ate the fruit. I disobeyed you, but it's your fault because you gave me the woman. I didn't even want her. It was your idea. I was happy with the, you know, talking to the animals and, you know, and walking around by myself. If you hadn't given me this woman, I wouldn't have sinned. It's your fault, God." In other words, he justified himself and blamed God. Unbelievable. And at that point, God stopped talking to him because, you know, he basically stated his will. He turned to Eve and gave Eve the same shot. You know, Adam was done. He dug his grave, literally. And he talked to Eve and he said, "Okay, Eve, same question. What did you do?" And Eve had that same option. She could have confessed and repented. She could have said, I was wrong and I'm sorry. And what can I do to make it right?" Nope. She basically did the same thing Adam did. She justified herself. She said, "Yeah, I ate it, but it's because of the snake. It's because of the nakash. He tempted me. It wasn't really my fault. I was tricked. I was fooled. I'm not to blame. You know, I was tricked. It wasn't my fault." She justified herself and blamed the nakash. And so then God was done talking to her. And of course, he didn't talk to the nakash to Satan because, you know, Satan's fate's already been sealed. He didn't need any more information from them. So what God wanted to do was to find out how they were going to justify themselves, who they were going to justify, who they were going to choose. And remember, the point of the dispensations is where God puts man in a situation, puts mankind into a situation where they have a choice to either choose themselves or choose God. And these questions were that opportunity to see whether this dispensation was going to succeed or fail. Who are you going to choose, Adam and Eve? Are you going to choose me, God, or are you going to choose yourselves? And they made it very clear that they chose themselves. They justified themselves and blamed God or blamed the nakash in the case of Eve. So they flat out failed the dispensation, failed it horribly. And so because of that, God had to be just and he had to judge them. And he had to pronounce the judgments on them. And we know the judgments. They're very familiar. We're going to talk about them more in a podcast down the road a bit. But basically, they got kicked out of the garden. Again, I'm running out of time, so I don't want to get into what the judgments were, because we're going to have a whole podcast just talking about the implications of the judgment. But they were both judged, and they were kicked out of Eden. And here's something interesting. When they were kicked out of Eden, God put two cherubim to guard, and a flaming sword, to guard the way to the tree of life. Why? Why did he put two cherubim to guard the way back to the tree of life? Well, the obvious answer is because he didn't want Adam and Eve to eat of the tree of life again, because they ate of the tree of life, they would be immortal. It was actually an act of mercy, because God has a plan for redemption. He needed them to be redeemed. But if they had eaten of the tree of life, they would have been immortal and would have lived forever in their fallen state. And God did not want that. He wanted to redeem them. He did not want them to live forever as fallen man and woman. He wanted them to be away from that tree of knowledge of good and evil so that they could be redeemed and not live. Because if they lived forever, they'd have no incentive to get restitution, to become redemed. Because why? If you're never going to die, what do you need redemption for? But it would not take two cherubim just to guard Adam and Eve from getting back to the tree. Why? Because angels, again, remember the cherubim, we talked about them in the last podcast. These are the most powerful angels that God created. It would not take two of them to keep Adam from getting back to the tree of life. In fact, one angel, one single regular old angel, not even a cherub, one night killed almost 200,000 Syrian troops. This is in the Book of Kings, I believe it's in Book of 2 Kings. One angel, a single angel, kills 200,000 Syrian troops. Not a cherub, just a regular old angel. You don't mess with angels. They're pretty powerful. So if one angel would have been more than enough to keep Adam from the tree, why two cherubim? Well, there's an old saying in the military, how do you stop a tank? You stop a tank with two other tanks. So how do you stop? So why do you need two cherubim? Well, you need two cherubim if you're going to stop one cherubim. Which cherub did they want to stop? Well, I think obviously Satan. They didn't want Satan getting back. God didn't want Satan getting to the tree of life. Why? Because if Satan could get to the tree of life, he could offer that tree of life to men, and he would get his goal of man never being redeemed, because if he would get to the tree, give the fruit to man, man would eat it and live forever, and God would not get his will. So those two cherubim were there to guard the other fallen cherub, Satan, from getting back to the tree of life. So that's that. You know, that's pretty much the narrative. That is the Eden narrative. And so here's the question now. We've gone through Genesis chapter 3. We've looked at the whole narrative. The question we have to ask is, what does it all mean? You know, what do we take away from it? Well, there are really two ways we can look at the story of Adam and Eve. Either it's real or it's not. Either it happened, either there was a literal man and woman named Adam and Eve who God created, or this is just an allegory. And if it's an allegory, then it's no different than any other mythology of how man came into knowledge of what he and she shouldn't have, like Pandora's box or the story of Prometheus or anything like that. And if you're an atheist or secularist, then that's exactly what you believe. You believe that the story of Adam and Eve is just a myth, just an allegory that people made up to help explain morality. Why? Because, you know, if you're an atheist and evolutionist and you believe that man evolved over millions and millions of years, we went from, you know, from fish to amphibian to lizard to mammal to man over millions of years, so obviously there was no literal Adam and Eve that were created. And interestingly, it's not just unbelievers who have the idea that Adam and Eve is a myth. That's actually the position of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church believes that Adam and Eve is just an allegory. Why? Well, because they have stupidly bought into the idea of theistic evolution, which is only slightly dumber than actual evolution, which, you know, several podcasts ago we went over why that's a completely ridiculous, ludicrous, impossible, scientifically impossible fairy tale. But the Catholic Church has bought into it, and they believe in theistic evolution, that God created the world, then he just let it evolve, which is almost not even, which is more akin to deism than actually a personal biblical creator who interacts with man, which is what the Bible clearly shows. Yet Catholics, well, not Catholics, but the Catholic leadership believes in theistic evolution. Silly stuff. But the, one of the huge problems with it is that they believe in a literal Jesus. They don't believe in a literal Adam and Eve, but they believe in a literal Jesus. But the problem with that is that in the book of Luke, in Luke chapter 3, there's a genealogy of Jesus, and in that genealogy is Adam. Well, you can't have a fake person in your genealogy. It just, if there's someone who's not real in your genealogy, then you're not real. I mean, if, you know, if in my genealogy I say, well, you know, my great 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 grandfather was Tom Sawyer or Huckleberry Finn, or you know, any other person, make believe person in literature, then I can't be real, because you can't have a not real person in your genealogy and you still be real. So you can't believe in a literal Jesus and not believe in a literal Adam if a literal Adam is in his genealogy. So I don't know how they deal with that contradiction. Well, actually, I do know how they deal with it. They ignore it. But so that's one option. If Adam and Eve, the story, if the Eden narrative is just an allegory, then, you know, you just look at it as any other story, you know, take what you want from it and move on. However, if it's real, if the story of Adam and Eve, the Eden narrative, actually happened, and I believe it does, and I believe the Bible is very clear that it does, the Bible doesn't even hint that it's an allegory. In fact, Jesus himself references Adam and Eve several times, as does Paul, as do other writers in the Bible. So they take them very seriously and literally. If there's a real Adam and Eve, if there was a real original sin, if that stuff, all that really happened, then that has huge, huge implications for the rest of history. And we have to examine everything that happened there and all of the ideas, topics, and terminology that were a part of the original sin narrative. Things like good and evil, we need to define them and look at good and evil. Life and death, these are two things that we hadn't talked about before. We haven't talked about what death means and what life means. We'll have to get into all that. We'll have to get into what sin means and what judgment means and why these things are necessary. And so we're going to do that. Because Adam and Eve were literal, they were real people who existed, and original sin really happened, we're going to examine it and what it, and the implications it has in our lives, because those implications are huge. And we're going to start in the next podcast by looking at justification, the thing that Adam and Eve had to do, the choice they had to make when God questioned them, is who were they going to justify? So in the next podcast, we're going to talk about justification. Why justification is necessary, why we have the need to justify someone when we do wrong, and what that's going to mean. And there are really two types of justification. Again, justifying justice, which is God, or justifying yourself over justice to try to balance the scales of justice. And that's something we have to do whenever you do something wrong. When you do something wrong, you've essentially violated justice. And you know that because you feel guilty about it. And you need to assuage that guilt, and you do it by justifying either yourself or by appealing to justice itself. And of course, God is just. God is justice. So that's going to be what we talk about. We're going to talk about justice and justification and what that means for us, and how the right form of justification will either get us right in line with God's plan or will guarantee that we are outside of God's plan, which we obviously don't want to be. All right, so let's wrap things up. We're a little over the 30-minute mark. So thank you for listening. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I appreciate it. Please follow me on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Please, please, please subscribe to the blog, subscribe to the podcast. If you're on faithbyreason.net listening to it here, then you can just look to your right and you will see the subscribe area. You just put your email in there and you will get the new podcast every week. You'll get the blogs when they come out. And I promise I will have a new blog post out soon. I've been kind of neglecting the blog as I've been getting the podcast going. There'll be a new one coming out pretty soon. Or if you just want to get it on your mobile device, you can look right under the player and you can subscribe through iTunes and Google Play and TuneIn Radio and Stitcher and all the other common ways to get it. But please subscribe. That would be great. I appreciate it. And I will talk to you next week.